Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Culture podcast, in which we have conversations about the culture we create and the impact we can make. I'm your host, Joshua Johnson. Go to shiftingculturepodcast.com to interact or donate. If you're enjoying the show, please tell your friends or your network about it so we could spread the word, and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating or review. It's greatly appreciated. In this episode, we have a great conversation with John Rittner. John just wrote a new book called Positively Irritating. We get into that, and then we get into his work as a pastor at Ecclesia Hollywood and how we can embody good news to the city in which we live. It's a fascinating conversation. John's a great communicator. You're going to really love this. So here is John Rittner. John Rittner, well, welcome to the Shifting Culture podcast. I'm excited to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Joshua. Appreciate it. It's good to make the connection. Look forward to talking.
Yeah, it's going to be good. You know, as I'm looking at your story, it's pretty fascinating to me as your journey went from a lot of different forms of church, a lot of different geographical locations. Walk us through your ministry journey and what Jesus has taught you along the way.
Man, yeah, it really has taken me all over the world, literally. I graduated from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago in 2012 and had just gotten married and went back to my college town of Williamsburg, Virginia, and came on staff at a church called the Williamsburg Community Chapel that was kind of in the midst of a lot of growth and, you know, spent 10 years there. And Virginia's, you know, some will say it's not quite the Bible Belt, but it's definitely... was in that Christendom culture where, you know, the question you might ask a new person is, hey, you know, are you looking for a church? Can I help you? Yeah. You know, or you might ask someone, where are you going to church? You would just expect church participation. And so I basically served for 10 years at a mega church. Eventually it was about 3,000 people in that Bible Belt Christian culture, you know, running day-to-day programs for existing Christians in many ways. And, you know, but probably like a lot of attractional style churches, you know, the goal is to kind of fill the calendar with activities and hope that that was actually discipling people into the way of Jesus. And and then hope that somehow the community would be interested in coming to participate in your programs and your services, you know. And then in my own journey, I just began to kind of sense God stirring in my heart that what we were doing wasn't working. It wasn't reaching the next generation. You know, I came to Christ as a college kid. And always have had a college Bible study, you know, to kind of stay young and fresh and to re-engage. And I could just sense like our programs aren't connecting with them. They're not interested in church the way we're doing it. And yet they are interested in Jesus and they're interested in spirituality. In fact, they're actually more interested in maybe changing the world out there than some of our church people are, you know? And so God kind of led us one day in a staff meeting. A friend of mine who was a missionary in Europe was there sharing, and God gave me this whisper of, you know, what if you could go to Europe, which was kind of the future of American culture in a lot of ways, this post-Christian, increasingly secular, post-church. You know, what if you could go there and learn from these experimenters who are trying new things and then come back eventually to America and help prepare the modern day church for this this era that's coming. And so we packed up and took our family of four over to Brussels, Belgium for 3 years and basically went from leading a mega church to helping plant little neighborhood micro churches in the city of Brussels, you know. And so if you're kind of familiar with that term, you know, those little communities, 20 to 40 maybe, that lived in a geographic area. And then we all came together once a month as kind of a citywide network to celebrate what was happening in our different neighborhoods. So
I think that's, you know, that's fascinating. You're doing that in Europe. As you know, my day job leading All Nations as a mission agency, our goal is to go out and ignite church planting movements. A lot of times we go plant micro churches that multiply around the world. And so this is, you know, this is where I live. The headspace that I live in is trying to figure that out. And as we've done that, we've also been able to be here in a local church in Kansas City where we have changed the model of church, and we've given up our building. We've become nomadic. We've split up into different house churches, and we get together once a month to come as a corporate gathering. And it's a great model for authentic community as we're living things out. We're walking out our relationship with Jesus. What did you find while you were in that world, in that mode, as maybe some of the really good things that brings and some of the things that maybe we're missing?
Yeah, you know, I think the one of the values of that, you know, people-driven discipleship movement, right? So, you know, yeah. So much of the American church today has been making disciples through programs, professionals, yeah. Doing it on a property. But this idea of equipping everyday people to make disciples out in the ordinary spaces of life, you know, the places they live, work, and play, you know, we talk about first, second, and third spaces. I think there's an incredible spiritual formation that happens when you really engage with that missional, incarnational, that sent life. You know, mm-hmm. One of the ways I phrased it is when someone else's spiritual maturity is partially dependent on you, you become more fully dependent on Jesus, right? Yeah. So it's not about inviting a friend to church so they can meet the pastor and hear him or her teach.
Right.
No. You are the missionary in that place. And so every day you are listening to the Holy Spirit, you're listening to the people you're serving, you're trying to discern what is good news, how do I embody it, what do they need, you know, how do I pastor someone? Well, man, that really can be overwhelming,
yes.
If you try to do it on your own, right? If you think, oh, I got, in my own strength, I'm going to care for these people. And so what it does is I think it really drives you into the presence of Jesus to say, man, I am not the right person for this, and I don't have the right skills, and I don't even know if I want to do this today, Jesus, but I believe you are, and I believe you are enough, and I believe you want to love these people, and so live your life through me, you know, that John 15, like abide in me and let me just kind of represent you in this space. So I think that spiritual formation that is more of an activist or a contemplative activist model where you're really like listening to the Spirit and then engaging in his work is so much more transformational than the classic Greek classroom, maybe even American Bible study model, you know, where we just kind of sermon you and Bible study you to death, but never really have a way of measuring, are you living this out, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, that the old idea that American Christians tend to be kind of educated beyond their level of obedience. in Europe, what I saw was that people were activating beyond their level of training and then coming back to you going, okay, something happened. I didn't know what to do. Can you help me?
Yeah.
You know? Which to me is very much right out of the Jesus disciple making movement. Send these men out who are ill-equipped and ill-prepared and trust that the Holy Spirit will join them. And then when they come back, debrief and say, hey, what happened? You know, and let's answer the questions that you now have as felt needs, you know?
Yeah. And that's beautiful. I have one trainer that we have really engaged with. And one of the things that he says is that people shouldn't get a new word unless they've obeyed the last word. And it was a huge little paradigm shift of, you know, coming from America and coming from, let's just give them all of the information and the education that they need all at once and just dump it on them. And hopefully that's going to transform their lives. But if you're actually starting to walk out into obedience and then coming back, debriefing, and then learning again and growing some more, it seems to be, you know, a good formation process.
It's funny you say that, Joshua, because I've had this idea and I've never really had the courage to pull it off. And maybe it's wisdom that I haven't tried, or maybe it's just, you know, fear. But I've wanted sometimes as a pastor to come back, you know, on a Sunday and, begin my message by reviewing last week's application and saying, hey, last week we said to obey God's word, we were going to do this. How, you know, tell me who did it.
Yeah.
And if the overwhelming majority couldn't apply it, then just say, well, you know what? I'm going to reteach that message because we don't need a new word. We haven't applied last week's word, you know, but that's the pressure I think we all feel in this American industrial, you know, disciple making system is every week I have to have something new and all the pressure's on me. And yet the average Christian often feels the freedom to just kind of consume it intellectually without any sort of accountability, you know? And, and so I will say the micro church experience provides a lot more accountability because you're all up in each other's business, so to speak, each week. You're often living life together. It's not just a worship gathering. We would have what we called serving communities and then friendship communities or expressions was the term so we'd have one night we were hanging out in the pub trying to live out there and do pub quizzes or beer tastings or something to add value, and then often we would have some sort of a serving expression at a local partner charity where we were going to add value there. Well, you know, that's three touch points during the week as well as other interactions that you'd have. So that was a micro church on mission together 7 days a week, you can find out pretty quickly who's all in and who's just wants to, you know, check a box on a Sunday morning.
Definitely. You can find out who's all in. Did you find, and when you were in Belgium, were you, was it really affinity groups that you were working with? Was it people that knew each other that formed a microchurch, or was it, neighborhood based?
Yeah, you know, we honestly, in 3 years, we experimented probably with all of that. And you know, we would have our leadership teams go in a retreat and we would kind of say, hey, we feel like the Spirit's, you know, blowing, let's try something different. So there was one season where we had a lot of young families. And so we said, man, that's kind of a unique need. So let's actually, rather than go geographic, let's put the families all together. They preferred to meet on a traditional Sunday morning because of their family life.
Yeah.
And then some of the young singles were meeting at, you know, 8 or 9 at night in public spaces.
Yeah.
They didn't want to get up at 10 o'clock, you know? And then we broke that down for a while and said, no, let's go back to the original vision, which was more neighborhood based.
Yeah.
And so you may only have like my kids didn't really have any peers when our gatherings came together, but what they had was a lot of intergenerational mentoring opportunities. They had adults who took interest in them, you know, and so we decided, well, that has value as well. So, you know, yeah, I mean, we did a lot of our outreach stuff was more affinity groups. So if we were going to form a community, it would be in a location like a pub and try to figure out how do we add value to this pub. Or it was around artists, you know. So I remember we had a jam session that would go every Thursday night. And it was in a neighborhood, in a set place.
Yeah.
But it tended to attract musicians from around the city who started to hear about it and wanted to participate, you know. So I think the big thing that we kept saying was, like, there is no model. The only church we're doing is contextual church, you know. So as long as you can make an argument that there's a context that we need to embed in, then let's try it, you know? And the other thing that did was it allowed a lot of freedom for people to begin to discern their own sense of calling, you know, what is my contribution? And so if you came with a passion for something, we'd say, hey, how do we equip you to do that? You know,
I think you hit on something really important there, and it's following the lead of the Holy Spirit and not being tied to a model. We're actually tied to, hey, Jesus is the center of what we do. We want to love and obey him. And out of that overflow of what we're doing, we actually see different expressions here in the city of what we're doing so that we could see the city flourish as what kingdom life is supposed to be. And so I think that's a huge point and a place where, you know, I've seen a lot of local pastors in the United States where all they're doing is like, on their hamster wheel, they're trying to keep it going, keep it spinning, because they have all these programs. They need to fill the building space. They need to do all sorts of different things. And so they probably have the freedom to follow the lead of the Holy Spirit, but it doesn't seem like they do to them.
Yeah. And Joshua, the thing I think, you know, you and I as white men have to be honest about is, when you have a set model, often your model is targeting a majority culture, and then asking everyone who doesn't fit into that majority culture to adjust to what you're doing. And so as we, I think, become more of a globalized world, right, where there's a lot more immigration and travel, and while we honestly, you know, the browning of America as the white experience is being decentered as the primary experience, and I think that's a healthy thing, we have to recognize that it's going to take a lot of different contextual expressions of church to reach the diverse, you know, human or American experience that we have. And and again, when you have held all the cards of power for so long, power and privilege, it's very hard to lay those down and to lay down the natural advantages that you've had. But I think if you look around, you see that this is actually one of the things that's held the church back. And it's given us kind of a negative reputation, is that we haven't done that. We haven't held our power in service of others. We've held it in a way that has served us and whoever the us is in the dominant culture. And traditionally, that's been kind of the white, rich, you know, male, right? And so that's part of my journey, too. And honestly, I was exposed to that through my time in Europe. I had my own kind of racial and ethnic cultural awakening as I served alongside, you know, Persians and Africans and even, you know, Europeans from different experiences, and realized that my experience of the world was not their experience. And even the way I engaged the city, there were certain advantages that were being afforded to me that they didn't have, even though we had similar status, you know. And that really kind of shook me up, and I had to do some kind of rethinking and repenting around the structures that I had created in my mind.
Yeah. And I've gone through a process where, you know, for a time I go, I'm a white male. I have a lot of power and I could walk through the world the way that I want to walk through the world. And so I've been through a time and a season where I've stepped back a little bit and not knowing how to engage, because I don't want to offend, or I don't want to really walk in somebody else's shoes that I'm not supposed to be walking in. And it was hard. But I heard recently somebody else on this podcast said that power is the capacity to bring capacity. And for me, that really, really helped me out, saying, actually, I do have the capacity to bring capacity towards other people and for other people. And I'm working for the good of others instead of working for the good of myself. And if I walk in that, and in that sense, there's all sorts of incredible empowerment things that I can walk into. And that really helped me out.
Yeah. I love that. I love that.
So as you went from, what made you decide to go back to the U.S. and L.A. specifically, and how did that work out for you?
Yeah, you know, the original sense of calling that we had was always that this was going to be like a short-term trip into the future, you know, that that there was a return in order to share the lessons that we were learning with the people back home, so to speak. And I think initially we thought maybe that was actually back in Virginia where we were, you know, we kept our house and stuff like that. But eventually we began to sense, no, we actually want to go to a city that is experiencing this post-Christian culture and where it's already dominating, you know, not where it's a couple of years off and you have to convince people it's coming, but we wanted to be in a space where the existing church was sensing, man, there's a huge shift and we don't quite understand it. And so, as we began to just kind of be open towards the end of year two and into year three, you know, through some relational connections, someone reached out to us who was trying to hire for this church here in Hollywood, California. And as I began to hear their experience, I realized, man, Hollywood is, you know, kind of the epitome of post-Christian culture in terms of what the American church even thinks of as, like, you know, the secular influence, right? Oh, Hollywood. I mean, I'll hear people say, oh, I didn't even know there were churches in Hollywood, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, there's 60, trust me, they're everywhere, you know? But just that impression that Hollywood is a mission field. And the recognition that for the people in my community here now at Ecclesia that I'm pastoring for 6 years, they know there is no institutional credibility in the church anymore in their world. You know, there is, they are rubbing shoulders every day in studios and on set and in writing rooms with people who have no interest in attending a Sunday worship service and don't actually think that the institutional church is a source of good news in culture. They see it actually as a source of bad news, you know, whether it's anti-science or anti-gay or judgmental or hateful or whatever. Man, they are not interested in that. And so if we're going to fulfill the mandate to make new disciples, these followers of Jesus who are artists and creatives they know that there has to be a strategy that can't begin with, oh, I'm going to invite them to church, because yeah. that the invitation is that that tool just doesn't work anymore, you know? Yeah. And so what I was so excited about was, oh, this is what I've been learning for 3 years in Europe, is what do you do when the invitation no longer has, you know, any attractive pull, so to speak? How do you actually invert that pipeline and don't lead with a worship service that then forms community and turns people into yeah. you know, living on mission? But how do you lead with mission? How do you actually go where they are and embrace the sentness of every disciple? And so as I was just kind of sharing that with this search team, they were thinking, oh, we want to learn. I said, well, I don't have the answers, but but I want to be part of a community that wants to experiment together, you know? Yeah. And so it's been a great 6 years of experimentation wow. and, you know, in failure, but also a lot of learning and a lot of yeah. successes. And so that's what my kind of latest season of life has been out here in Hollywood.
That's good. I remember, I think a couple of years ago, I watched your food truck church video. And I was really fascinated with that analogy. Can you expand on that? What is that analogy and what does it look like?
Yeah, you know, one of the things you learn pretty quickly when you're working with artists is that the power of story and image and metaphor, you know, is often what speaks to people's hearts. And so I was trying to figure out, how do you communicate this new paradigm to my church, but then also to the to others who would be interested in joining our mission? And, you know, we ended up kind of thinking through the old way of church in the American system as kind of a restaurant church, you know? So a restaurant yeah. is a brick and mortar place that has a good reputation, has a professional chef, sometimes even a celebrity chef. There's a trained group of employees who are very specific in what they do. One's the host, one's the waiter, one's the chef. And, you know, they hang up a sign and people are willing to come try their food. And if their yeah. food is good, they gain an audience and they grow, and maybe even they franchise and expand, or at least they build a, you know, a larger building. And in many ways, that's what the American church has been like yeah. in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You know, if you got a great speaker, and if you created a cool vibe, and if you served a good meal, more people came. And they so many came that you had to keep expanding.
Right.
But in, you know, we've all had restaurant experiences where you hear about a restaurant that all of a sudden, you know, they were all into the cool, trendy dish, but now nobody wants that anymore. Yeah. Or a restaurant that, you know, had a crime committed in it, or a restaurant that had, you know, got an F health inspector rating. And everyone's like, I am never going to that place again. Yeah. Right. Well, what's that restaurant supposed to do? How do they fulfill their mission if no one is willing to come? And so, you know, the analogy we kind of used was, that's a little bit of what's happened. So what if the church didn't think about running a restaurant, but what if the church existed more like a fleet of food trucks? Mm-hmm. You know, what if we reimagined ourselves in a new paradigm as small teams that were sent out into different nooks and crannies mm-hmm. of the culture, you yeah. know, that, you know, set up shop, so to speak, and then served a very contextual gospel meal, you know, Korean hot wings, you know, lobster rolls, you know, fish tacos, something that was unique and intriguing yeah. that would draw people in. And then we actually became part of that neighborhood for the day, or part of that people group for the day, and kind yep. of tried to fit in. You know, we're here to serve you, so to speak. And then at the end of the day, all those food trucks in LA, and they're all over, right? But they tend yep. to park at a food truck hub, or what's sometimes called a commissary. And so this idea that you go out and then you come back, and when you come back, you all park together. And often what they do is they debrief, they celebrate the wins. They yeah. they say, hey, you know, they're not competing, because they were in different neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know? And then usually they're part of a membership of this hub commissary where they can restock on paper products and food at discounts, you know?
Yeah.
And so we said, man, what if the rhythm of our church was more like food trucks that went out during the week,
yeah.
partnered together in small teams, served others, cared for others, and then came back together on a Sunday and shared stories and got refueled in the presence of the Spirit and celebrated the wins and grieved the losses.
Yeah.
And then we figured out, what are the tools they need that we can give them so they can be successful this week? How do they restock
yeah.
in the presence of our community? You know, so So that analogy started resonating. And so then, you know, the video you saw, we found people in our community who were artists and voiceover actors and a producer and a director. And just our community created kind of a little 3-minute explainer video that we use on our website, and other organizations have used to kind of just paint this picture of maybe a new way of thinking about church.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What is how does it look practically for you as the church to really be these food trucks during the week? What does it look like practically?
Yeah, so, you know, as everyone knows, COVID is such a wrench in all this, and what anything looks like in COVID is kind of crazy, right? But what I will say is, going into COVID, we were at a place where we were becoming more of this hybrid style. So we recognized that you're not going to shut down the restaurant overnight and mobilize everyone into food trucks. But we were beginning to identify some pioneers, some innovators and early adopters who wanted to experiment with these new ways of being. And so we were equipping them while still running the restaurant, but even within the restaurant, casting vision for it, you know? And so we probably had about 4 or 5 different food truck expressions that were happening during the week. Mm. The one that I see most often is a co-working space for independent artists that we call Epiphany Space. And it was a nonprofit formed by one of our Ecclesia community members who recognized that if you're an independent filmmaker, writer, actor, this city is incredibly lonely. Most people move here to follow the dream. They have no family. You know, you're in your car often, you know, it doesn't have those natural connection points like many cities do, you know? And so she wanted to care for people and help them flourish as artists by creating collaboration moments. And so, she created this Epiphany Space, and then our staff offices, we actually decided to kind of embed in there. So our 6-person staff just took over, you know, one of the rooms as like a subscriber, because we want to help be missionaries there. And, you know, this weekend they've got a short film festival going on. They do all sorts of writing workshops and songwriter events. And then they also have, you know, an ongoing kind of prayer group. And every now and then they'll have kind of a spiritual study group, you know, Life of Jesus or a book. And so if people are interested in that, they can participate. But really, the fruit is often coming from seeds that are planted in just ongoing conversations, you know, over coffee outside on the patio or on our Wine Wednesday happy hour that we do, you know. And we've seen people make decisions to follow Jesus who were not interested in coming to a church, and we never invited them to church. You know, we sent the church there, so to speak, you know. And so similar expressions, you know, a guy who wanted to care for a specific corner of LA where homelessness had really gone rampant, and he began going there every week. And so we helped him recruit a team. And, you know, over the course of 2 years, you know, they kind of emptied that corner out. He helped some of them get jobs. He, you know, just walked with them relationally. We did a big Christmas clothing drive for that one community. But again, the thing that we've learned is the starting point is often talking with someone about how is the Spirit forming you and leading you to serve this city. It's not we've got a mission or a project or you have to do it in this way. It's we want to come alongside you. We want to equip you, you know. And so if you have some area that you're passionate about, let's help you figure out what would it look like to help that part of LA suck a little less, you know, which is something I say in a book. We use that phrase, what sucks in your life? You know, does it suck for anybody else? And could you work together to make it suck less for everybody? You know, and so that's sometimes perfect. That connects with non-church people. They go, yeah, I like that. I want to make it suck less.
Yeah, I do want to make the world suck less. Of course I do. That's good. So what was your purpose? You wrote this new book, Positively Irritating. What was the purpose of that book for you? What do you want to see it accomplish?
Yeah, the you know, what I recognized as I came back from Europe to America and what we were doing in Hollywood was I sensed a lot of churches and a lot of church leaders recognizing that what they were doing wasn't working anymore the way it did in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, but they just didn't know what else to do. You know, their brain was kind of fixed on a certain way of doing church, and they were struggling to find, you know, imaginative ways to reshape that. And so I realized, gosh, my journey actually of kind of deconstructing my church model and entering into liminality, crossing over this threshold where I didn't have all the answers, and I had to reassume the position of a learner and experiment again. And then coming back to America and beginning to try out what we had learned, man, this is not a bad pathway. You know, it's not a plan. It's not a, you know, fail proof if you, these four steps, but the journey we've been on is a journey that is connecting with leaders as I would share it. And so, you know, the analogy that I use and where the title Positively Irritating comes from is just that, you know, the post-Christian world has become an irritant for most churches.
Yep.
It is something that's bugging them, that's bothering them, that they kind of wish would go away. You know, I wish we could go back to the good old days where everyone went to church on a Sunday and, you know, 10 o'clock Sunday morning, there were never any youth sports or, you know, any of the, whatever their memory is of how the church was centered. And so if you think about the power of an irritant, we tend to think of it as negative, but the same grain of sand, you know, that gets in your eye at the beach and causes an irritation and drives you crazy. It makes you rub and rub and rub and want to get rid of it because, you know, if it doesn't, it'll lead to, you know, infection.
Yeah.
That same grain of sand can get into, you know, the mantle or the bed of an oyster. And the oyster's response is not to try to eliminate it. It's to actually embrace it. And as the oyster embraces this irritant with, you know, layer upon layer of this substance called nacre, it ends up creating a pearl. And so the point is, and the irritant is not the issue. It's the response to the irritant, and that your response as an organism reveals actually how healthy you are. And so, you know, as a church, and then of course, COVID came out, COVID was breaking into the world right as we were in our final draft. And so we thought, oh my gosh, it's another irritant that we have to face.
Yeah.
And so the timing really was providential because a lot of people were, that was the primary irritant they were thinking about. Well, how do you embrace the irritant to make something beautiful that you can then give to the world as a gift?
Yeah.
You know, my favorite part of that analogy is that it's in our culture today, it's not the oyster that enjoys the pearl. It's the human, you know, the oyster made the pearl and then the pearl became a blessing for others. And so how do we create something of beauty that the world will enjoy, not just our church people?
Yeah. Have you seen any examples of that during COVID that you've actually seen people embracing the irritants and making something beautiful?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of our community is recognizing the value of living locally and really going like, well, I'm not driving all over LA anymore, you know, especially in COVID. I wasn't going anywhere. I was shopping at the one store, you know.
And it
you
took an hour to get there and, you know.
And so, you know, all you really had was kind of neighbors around you. And, you know, what I loved was watching people say, let's create these kind of COVID pods or, you know, everyone had different language for them, you know, we talked about even forming kind of like trios, but basically another family or two that you'd be safe, you feel safe with, you know? And so I feel like there were a lot of neighborhood relationships that were deepened and formed, which are leading to, you know, relational disciple making, that people just walked right by their apartment. One of the ironies of big city life that I'm learning from being here in LA is because you're around people all day.
Yeah.
If you live in an apartment, the apartment is the last place you want to be engaging with people. That's like your safe space. So the minute you get out of your car and you get in the elevator and you walk the hallway, it's almost like, ugh, I don't want to talk to you, neighbor.
Right. Yeah.
This is my space. And so it's the opposite of suburban life where your neighbors become the people you might want to interact with because you might have been cooped up all day alone, you know? And so this kind of flipped it. We all actually felt like, oh, I'm not seeing people all day. And so I remember, you know, we got to know our neighbor who was outside playing guitar every day at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we just walked out as a family and said, hey, what's your name? We love your guitar playing. And I'd never met the dude until COVID, you know? So just, you know, I think that's one picture that our family kind of was noticing was, man, this is actually creating a better rhythm of local living than we had before.
Yeah. What's the, As you're trying to make disciples that go out and make new disciples, and actually are transformed from the inside so that they could impact the community and the culture around them, there's a couple things. One is it seems very complex within a city because there's so many different challenges in a major city like LA. How can people and disciples go and impact the culture around them and even have a hope to transform a big major city like LA?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you a story because it was eye-opening for me. One of the we started something called Missional Imagination Workshops at Ecclesia. They were basically post-Sunday worship service experiences that we invited people to join if they were interested in engaging their neighborhood as a missionary. And we were seeing kind of 70% of our worship attendance come over. It was amazing. But wow. One of the first, and then we would gather in neighborhoods and to try to introduce people to someone, again, LA neighborhoods, meaning at least 5 miles from each other, not on the same cul-de-sac. But we did an experiment one time, like an imagination event or what I call it, activity or something, where I told them, imagine that your team of 8 people sitting in a circle is going to go live in a biodome, and you're going to go live in this biodome for 3 years, you know, and your job is to cultivate the ground and establish rhythms of life. And, you know, everyone will have a role and all that kind of stuff. But I want you to imagine forming a church in that biodome and with the 8 of you as the starters, you know, what would that look like? What would you do? Come up with a strategy, come up with tactics, what roles you might play. And we gave an hour to come up with it, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the irony is when everyone reported back, nobody led with, oh, well, we'd find a building. We'd hire a worship team. We'd figure out who plays guitar. None of that kind of stuff. No one even said we'd pick a pastor. What they all basically said was we'd probably just gather, you know, in our homes and then begin to serve others and stuff. And so people had incredible strategies of how to add value to the biodome, right? And at the end, I said to them, you know, this is what it means to start a food truck. This is what it means to be a church planter. It's to, you know, just simply what keeps us from doing this in LA? And I'm telling you, across the room, people jumped right on it. And they said, here's the thing, John, you told us we would be in one space for 3 years. That's not true in LA. We have no idea if we're going to live in the same house or apartment for 3 years. People are moving all the time. Number two, you told us we were going to be working with the same people, those 8 people for 3 years. There's no guarantee that's going to happen. And number three, because you put a dome over that location, the missional context we were in was very defined. And they said the LA life is perpetual moving around, always gaining and losing friends, and a massive footprint that you live in, where you work here, live here, play here.
Yep.
And that was such an eye-opener for us because I realized we have to create more micro environments. You know, you can't even say, I'm going to reach Hollywood, I'm going to reach Burbank, I'm going to reach Warner Brothers. It's too big.
Yep.
You know? And so how do you create longevity, you know, how do you create sustainability?
Yeah,
it begins much smaller. And to be honest, Joshua, the big challenge that we're finding right now is the history of our church was, you know, Ecclesia was, you know, 700 people, attractional, commuter, drive from all over the city because you were in the entertainment industry. And so kind of the remnant that I have left after those days are long gone for them. Yeah. And I came after a lot of that fallout, but the remnant you have left don't live in proximity with other quote unquote Ecclesians. They're the only ones within their neighborhood. And so they're not going into a biodome with 8 other people. And so they feel very isolated and alone. And so, you know, we've talked about maybe you need to discern who else, you know, loves Jesus, but attends another faith community, another church. Yep. Maybe you need to figure out, you know, who doesn't care about Jesus, but cares about the cause that you care about. You know, they may not want it for the reason you want it, but they, you know, their why may not be the same, but their what might be the same. And that's okay. That's a starting point. They want to bless the school, you know, or they want the school to be safer. Hey, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, so It's led to a lot of, I mean, I share that analogy just because I think that I go back to that biodome thing a lot, because my people had no problem being creative in a biodome. They knew how to do it.
Yep.
The issue is LA is not a biodome.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. And I think that's across the board, across the world, in major cities, this is what I think everybody's trying to figure out. What does it look like, especially in a migratory community? And, you know, you have different people coming in and out all the time. You know, in a rural community, you have a stabilized village of people that stay there and form community. And that community is its own little culture. But there are so many different cultures in a major city. And not to mention now there are so many different like worldwide cultures. We have people from all over the world that are coming into our city. And so immigrants and refugees, and there's all sorts of challenges in a city. And so it actually says, hey, Holy Spirit, what are you doing? How can we join you? Give us the answer. And, you know, for me, a lot of people ask me how they could pray for All Nations, our mission agency. Mm. And the only thing I ever tell them is, I want to hear from Jesus and do what he says, because I can't come up with strategy to reach every single nation that we're in, or I can't come up with a strategy to reach Kansas City, or Jesus has to do it. And the Holy Spirit in me, who's given me discernment and wisdom, has to do it. So I need to listen and then obey. And so what sort of a posture do you need in that city to be able to make an impact and an influence? How can we posture ourselves as disciples of Jesus in the world so that we can make an impact in a way where we're so busy and we're just like, hey, doing so many things? We often think that, hey, ministry time is, we can't do it because we're too busy. So how do we posture ourselves?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as some, you know, again, I did 10 years of ministry in a very suburban environment. And now having done the last 9 years in these two urban environments, I think I'm realizing that the posture of spirituality is very different. And in the suburban environment, I often felt like my role as a pastor was to try to catalyze behaviors, catalyze engagement with the world around, you know, kind of this ministry of engagement that, hey, people were looking for meaning in life. You know, they were a lawyer or a restaurateur or a chef. And they kind of felt like, well, yeah, that's my day job, but I don't really know what I'm doing to make an impact in the kingdom, you know? Yeah. And so, and they'd give big to a building program because they felt like at least they were contributing to something bigger than themselves. And so if you led, you know, whether it was street evangelism or mission trips or, you know, a caring for a nonprofit, people love joining you because they wanted to engage in order to experience Jesus more, because the mundane life, they didn't experience Jesus, right?
Yeah.
The temptation for me then was when I went to an urban environment to think, all right, so my job is to give people more activities so they could experience Jesus. The irony of an urban environment is most people who are willing to make the sacrifice to live in an urban environment, they are already there living in small homes for less money in cramped environments because they have a sense of calling that put them there, and they have to be there to fulfill their calling. So think about Hollywood, right?
I mean,
someone feels called to tell stories, to be an artist, to create beauty. They know Hollywood is where I have to go to do it. Now, if they've moved here, the cost of living is insane. The taxes are nuts. You know, you can't afford to buy a home. You're stuck in your car all day. Yes, there's a lot of sunshine, but they're making a lot of sacrifices in order to already fulfill their calling. And so there's not a lot of margin in their life. So what they're actually longing for, and the posture that I'm trying to, you know, kind of speak to them, is more of a posture of disengaging from the rat race of the world.
And
a sustainable posture of Sabbath and rest and stillness and listening, you know, it's not saying, hey, you know, you got to get out there and do more for the kingdom. It's saying you're already out there trying to embody Christ in the kingdom, but that you will not be able to sustain that if you're doing that 24/7, you know? So like we did a whole series on Sabbath, and it just, people really resonated with it because the Hollywood world is all about the hustle.
Yep.
It's not about taking a day of rest, you know? And so, you know, I had guys even, you know, saying, listen, if I don't drive Uber on my quote unquote Sabbath day, on my day off from my other job, I don't know if I'll pay the bills. And I remember one guy saying, I'm going to trust God in this and deciding to not work a second job, or for him, I think it was actually a third job on his Sabbath.
Wow.
And say, no, I'm going to try to lean into Jesus and listen to the Spirit and, you know, go out in nature, and then watching God provide for him, you know? So
that's good.
It's ironic, right? Cause you think, oh, we want to see impact, tell everyone to do more. And yet you realize actually for sustainable impact, there has to be that rhythm of breathing in and breathing out and saying, hey, we're doing less, you know? So I met with a guy the other night who is a filmmaker, and during COVID, one of the practices he's got into is this school of deep recovery breathing that was founded by this guy named Wim Hof, who's a mountain climber and an extreme diver. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot going on out here now in this world of not just meditation, because that has kind of negative connotations, but I would say mindfulness and breathing and stillness, that really it's believers are using it as a way to root themselves in the presence of God. Yeah. You know, there's, you know, get off your phone. I mean, this is the liturgy of our world today is our phones.
Yep.
And so we've got to disconnect from that in order to, you know, be mindful of Jesus so that we can then join him in what he's doing.
Yeah. I mean, we have so many people right now on our staff and my friends that we are really trying to lean into Sabbath rest. And this is the conversation that we have now. Just last weekend, my wife and I went on an anniversary trip. We were coming back and we were talking about our Sabbath and what we can do to be more intentional in Sabbath. And during that conversation, there was all sorts of identity issues that came up, and there was resentment that came up. There was all like junk that was in our souls that I think was a spiritual attack of saying, this is not good for you. You need to still go out and hustle, and your identity is in what you do, not in who you are and who God says you are.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I had that realization halfway through our conversation, which was healthy and good, and it wasn't like a week later, so it was good. It was right there, and say, hey, let's reorient even this conversation and know that this is an important thing that we're doing and heading into, so we really have to take this seriously, and it's not just a flippant thing, let's get a little time of rest, and then so that we could do more activity later. There's something really important and special about Sabbath.
Yeah. And you know, we all know there are demons in that darkness, right?
Yep.
I mean, there are ghosts in that quietness. And so so much of our Western culture that is about perpetual energy and accomplishment and achievement is, you know, is partly, I think, to keep us from the pain we feel when we stop and be quiet, you know, and the contemplative voice. And so, you know, I love Alan Hirsch talks about this idea of kind of being the contemplative activist, you know, balancing, holding those in tension, you know. So I think about that as the breathe in, breathe out rhythm of life. You know, I have to renew and refuel and restore. And then I offer something that the world needs in the carbon dioxide breathing out.
Yeah.
But if I don't breathe in deeply, you know, and have that intake, then I have nothing to output.
Yeah. There's just a couple of questions I like to ask at the end. Yeah. The first one is, if you could go back to your 21-year-old self, what advice would you give?
Man, I think I would say, I think one of the things I'd say is it's all going to be okay in the end. You know, like there was the 21-year-old version of me. I'd been a Christian for 2 years, was so strategic and anxious and you know, programmed and planning, you know, I remember even at 21 thinking, if I'm not married by 25, I'll kill myself. Cause man, that would just be the end of life. You know, I want to be changed in the world for Christ. And that's going to start with having a wife. And so if I can't get that done by 25, you know, and of course the irony of a story I tell is that on my 25th birthday, I was surrendering that to God and realizing how silly that was. And my wife, who is simply just a grad student, you know, happened to be at the fire pit the night I had that realization. And I just always think of Jesus laughing, going, yeah, I needed to get you here so you could surrender that. And now I'm going to introduce you to Kristen, you know. But yeah, I think I see it in my own kids. You know, our culture is just such a anxiety producing, comparison driven. If you have any of that Enneagram 3 achiever in you, which I do, I think I'd love to go back and say, it's all going to be okay. Yep. You know, it's all going to be okay in the end. And so you don't need to feel that burden as much, you know, which probably would make me a little stiller in the presence of Jesus, you know?
I mean, I have that Enneagram 3 as well, and I feel it. I feel it. I heard Ian Cron said once that the first half of your life is like the parable of the talents, and the second half of your life is like the parable of the prodigal son as he's coming home to figure out who he truly is. And that thing for me helps me in a transition of like, okay, what do I want to do to slow down and really figure out, as a beloved son of God, who am I? And that was,
I mean, just to embrace that truth that you are already enough, you know, you're enough because he's enough, and to not have to go through life proving your value. I think, I'm still struggling to learn that. So part of me is like, I would still say this to my 45 year old self, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Anything you've been reading or watching lately that you could recommend?
Yeah, you know, one of the books that really kind of wrecked me recently, and let's see, I'm going to get the title right because then I taught on it for a little bit. It's called Unclean by Richard Beck, and he's a professor at maybe Asbury Seminary or something. But he really just walks through that Matthew 9 story of Jesus and the Pharisees and how they encounter Matthew's tax collector party and the two postures, you know. And it's really a book about, you know, he frames it as a book about holiness and holiness through the grid of purity and separation, which is the Pharisees going, hey, we're so holy, we can't be a part of this sin, so we have to stay out here. And Jesus reframing holiness through the lens of kind of missional engagement and saying, actually, my holiness is what is compelling me to go in there, because I believe that I have the power to positively influence them, you know? And so the metaphor that he talks a lot about is the idea of positive and negative contamination. You know, he uses the analogy of, you know, a drop of urine into a glass of lemonade makes you think, I'm not drinking the lemonade, right? But if you put a drop of lemonade into a glass of urine, you still think, I'm not drinking this, right?
Exactly.
Because urine is a negative contaminant. No matter what it touches in your mind, it's now filthy. But Jesus is constantly using metaphors of positive contamination. So light in darkness. He says just a little bit of light is more powerful than the darkness. Just a little bit of salt flavors everything. Just a little bit of leaven impacts everything, right?
Yeah.
And the thing, and the value thing, and then it actually gets better. You know, not worse.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it really impacted how I think about engagement with the world, that are we afraid that the world is going to stain us, which is often the impulse in secularization. Don't go to Hollywood. They'll stain you. They'll ruin your family. Yeah. Right. Rather than the missional view of holiness, which is you need to go to Hollywood because you might help bring beauty there.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the sent impulse, and really to me the way of Jesus. So that book gave me such language. That's called Unclean by Richard Beck.
Yeah. I think that's great. I want to go check that out now. I also want to encourage everybody to go out and read Positively Irritating by John. John, it was such a privilege to talk to you. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming on.
Me too, Joshua. Hope we get to see each other in person.
Yes.
Soon here in the world of conferences and gatherings. And love to come see what you're all doing in Kansas City.
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the show today. If you're really enjoying the show, please don't forget to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app. You could do it right now. Just hit that little plus. And then I would love it if you would leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. So you could go right now to the show and leave a star rating and review and let us know how you are enjoying the show. And find us on Facebook and Instagram. So if you want to connect, interact, I post a lot of quotes and different things that you could actually interact with the episodes and let me know how you are enjoying the show. If you feel inclined to donate, there is a support the show link in the show notes, and it would send you directly to a page where you could donate so that new episodes can be produced for your enjoyment. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have an incredible week.